Welcome to Trailblazers, where we explore the inspiring journeys of entrepreneurs and industry leaders who are redefining success and making a lasting impact. These game changers are driving progress in our region and around the world. I'm Melody Bradford, your host. Some stories break the internet. John Grogan's broke our hearts in the best possible way. Before Hollywood came calling, before Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston stepped into his world, before millions of readers around the globe laughed and cried with him, there was just a man, a keyboard, and one wildly imperfect dog named Marley. On this episode of Trailblazers, I'm thrilled to be sitting down with John Grogan, New York Times bestselling author of Marley and Me and The Longest Trip Home, to talk about the stories behind the stories, from newsroom deadlines to movie sets, from family memories to unexpected fame. John's journey is packed with love, loss, risk, reinvention, and the beautiful chaos of a dog who became a global icon. John, welcome to Trailblazers, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Melody.
All right, so this year we are celebrating 20 years since the release. Right now we're sitting, this will air at the end of October, but October 18th, 2005 was when you released, and you became an instant bestseller, reaching number 10, right, on the New York Times bestseller
week.
List.
Yep.
I mean, let's just take a moment. What did that feel like? I mean, wow, you know?
Well, when I wrote Marley and Me, I was getting up early in the morning before my wife and children were up. I had three kids and a job, and I was writing, and I really believed in the story. I felt it in my heart that I had a good story, but I also thought, like, well, this is just about my life. It's a small story, and I'll probably find a small audience, and my marketing director would probably be my mom telling all her friends about it. So it was a surprise when it just started picking up steam even before it hit the bookshelves. There was like a word of mouth going on. It was really unusual. Mm. And I was like, what is happening here? And then it came out at number 10 and just kept going up from there.
Your journey to Marley and Me began long before the book even hit shelves. Can you take us back to the moment that you realized Marley's story was worth sharing with the world?
Yes. Well, it happened incrementally over his whole lifetime. So my wife and I are newlyweds, and we get this cute little house in South Florida where we were both working as reporters at newspapers. And we brought home this puppy. And right from the start, he was pretty comedic. He was a crazy, hyperactive dog. And I started telling these stories at dinner parties and at the office. And he was always making people laugh. These stories got a good reaction. And I became a newspaper columnist, so you start getting an instinct for what works with an audience and what doesn't. And so right from the start, I thought, there's something with Marley. And at first I thought, maybe it's a collection of funny essays, but that didn't feel like enough. I had all these funny anecdotes, but what I didn't have was like a story. And then 13 years later, Marley, a very old dog at this point, dies of an old age related ailment. And I wrote a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer saying farewell to this basically pain in the neck dog who we also just loved to death. And I got a really huge response to that column, like 8-10 times what I would normally get. And I thought, God, I struck a nerve with this. And I like sort of woke up the next morning with all these letters and emails coming in. And I thought, like, oh, I see my story now. Now it has an ending.
Yeah.
It starts with a young couple trying to figure their life out together as newlyweds. They bring this dog into their life who's basically a catalyst to challenge the couple. And all couples have some kind of challenge, right? And then 13 years later, we have grown as a couple. And the dog is aged and has changed us as we've changed him. And then we say goodbye to the dog. And I said, that's my story. Oh. And a week later, I was sending letters out to agents, literary agents.
Wow. And did you ever think at any point that it would become a movie?
Not at first, not at all. I was actually surprised that it was like getting a lot of readership. But then, you know, my agent works with a California, Los Angeles agent who specializes in books to film. Mm. And he was interested in showing it around Hollywood. So I knew it was a possibility at that point. But a lot of times books get optioned and nothing ever happens. Mm-hmm. They never actually get the funding for a movie. But mine happened pretty quickly. I don't even think I had hit number one yet. And I had a deal with, you know, one of the big major studios, 20th Century Fox.
That's incredible. So, okay, you know, I mean, typically I'm talking to quote-unquote trailblazers, right, about their leadership journey through their companies or, you know, their career or whatever. From your perspective, you were a journalist. And so before becoming a best-selling author, you spent quite a bit of time in journalism, right?
About 25 years, yeah.
What were some of the biggest pivots or risks you took along your career path that made space for storytelling at this scale? Or did this kind of, I mean, obviously it was a game changer, right? But
yeah.
But I mean, what allowed you, because even if you watch the movie, there was a little bit of a pivot there, right? You were covering different stories, maybe not necessarily following your passion journalistically. And then all of a sudden you just started to speak from the heart and it just resonated. Can you tell me a little bit about that pivot, about taking that risk and what that was like for you?
Yeah, for me, the pivot was fairly early in my career. You know, I was a young journalist doing hard news at newspapers, mm-hmm. police, crime, courts. And I also had this real hankering to write creative writing. And so I saw them as two separate things. I'd do my, you know, just the facts, ma'am, news reporting during the day. And then at night, I'd write short stories and other fiction and things like that. And then I applied to a mid-career journalism graduate program at Ohio State that specializes in people who have 5 or more years experience in the field. And I got in. And when I was there, I met this professor, John Clark, and he taught literary journalism. I'd never heard of it, but it's the art of writing factual, true stories like journalists do, well reported, but in using the techniques of fiction. So it reads like a story with a beginning, middle, end, and rising action and a climax and all of that. And it changed my life. I came out of that graduate program and I pretty quickly pivoted to writing more creative narrative nonfiction for my newspapers. And then I became a columnist and I was able to write first person narratives. So like little tiny stories from the perspective of me as the columnist. And I learned pretty quickly, like the more I put myself in it and the more personal it was, the more readers reacted because they felt they knew me. So when I sort of stood up on a rock as like a third party observing something and kept myself out of it, I would get a nice reaction. But if I was talking from my own perspective, things that affected me or my family, I would be rewarded by readers. So really, that's where it began, where I started figuring out the art of reaching a reader through story and through narrative. And then as a columnist, I was really making that transition into mining my own life for first person.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny about the movie is that they kind of, to simplify the story, they make it sound like I never found a good thing to write about until I started writing about Marley. The reality is I think I wrote about a half dozen Marley columns over my whole columnist career.
Okay.
I was writing a lot off the news and about things in our community. But those columns always did well.
Yeah.
And they were mostly sort of funny humor columns. But then that last column is when I really sort of saw the story, as I said a second ago. So that was my pivot, was learning that you can do accurate nonfiction that's well reported, write it like a fictional story, and readers will engage in that. Because I think all of us are hardwired to seek out a good story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of our survival instincts over the evolution of humans,
mm-hmm.
is that those who understand the story of how to survive, how to figure life out, are the ones who carry their genes forward.
Yeah. So historically, and you said a couple of things that were pretty interesting, because a few people have come to me actually and said, you should put what you're gathering here on this podcast into a book format. And I'm like, what? Really? I mean, you know, but I'm curious to find out, when this memoir, if you will, turned into a movement that you realized it was like, I mean, my goodness, it kind of became its own brand, you know? So you went from this journalist columnist to this book author to this global sensation. How did it feel to become a movement? And when did you know it was becoming a movement? Was it the call from Hollywood?
And I think it was before that, actually. There were signs really early, you know, like before a book is published, it starts circulating. People show it to booksellers and librarians to see who wants to pre-order. Mm-hmm. And it was getting a lot of word-of-mouth buzz. People were really engaging with my book. And so all these signs were super positive. And my literary agent, who really was the first person to really believe in this book, even before me, Lori Apkemeyer at DeFiore & Company in New York, she was like, this is going to be a bestseller. And I'm like, oh, you're just trying to make me feel good. But she like called it like weeks before the book came out. And she was right. Mm-hmm. And it started at number 10. And by like about 3 months later, it hit number one. And it stayed at number one on the New York Times for 23 weeks.
Wow.
Which is really unheard of. And I was like every day pinching myself. Is this really happen? And then I got the movie deal. And
I want to know, what did Jenny do in all of this? Was she like, what? Yeah, right. I mean, like, what was happening in your household at that time?
Yeah, well, Jenny, you know, was super excited for me, of course, but also was like, you know, she sees me put my socks on every morning. And she's like, don't let this go to your head too much.
You know? You still have to take the garbage out.
But, you know, right? She believed in the story, too. It's our story. I mean, it's like, people call it a dog memoir, and in one way it is, but it's actually really the story of a young marriage in formation and like a couple trying to figure their life out. And, you know, that's always a big question mark for any marriage. Is it going to last? Is it going to survive?
Yeah.
And then you have this crazy catalyst that comes into your world and turns it upside down. Mm-hmm. Are they going to figure it out or is it going to break them?
Mm-hmm.
And so those were the tensions in the story. And I think that's part of what people related to.
Yeah.
Because not everyone has a dog, but everybody has a relationship, and relationships are hard.
And sometimes catalysts that they have to, challenges they have to overcome. So you wrote Marley and Me, but you also wrote The Longest Trip Home. Let's talk about that for a second here. First of all, can you give us some background on that? Because it may not be as widely known as Marley and Me. Tell us what inspired you to write such a deeply personal memoir about family identity and faith.
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in this very loving, devout, very Catholic family in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan. And this is another story that once I left home and was an adult, I thought, like, you know, there is a story there, because I didn't share my parents' deep faith in the church. And so there was always that tension. And, you know, whenever there's a tension, a writer's like, tension's good for story, because a story without tension is not much of a story. So I felt it, but I think sort of like Marley and Me had to play out over the life of the dog Marley, my story about my growing up experience and being a son to parents and having different sort of faith values was something I had to wait until that fully played out. So I really... It just so happened that as Marley and Me was climbing the bestseller list, my father died and I lost him. So it was a very odd time for me. I was elated one moment and I was like crying in the bathroom the next moment because there was so much grief over the loss of my dad.
Sure.
We were super close. And yet I always felt there was this like chasm between us because he wanted me so much to be the really devout Catholic that he was, and I just really wasn't. So I explore that in the book. And again, a little bit like Marley and Me, a lot of it are kind of funny moments growing up Catholic when you're trying to sort of spread your wings as a kid and then as a teenager, and yet still keep your parents feeling like you're on the right track. And so I just tell the story from my earliest memories all the way until I was a 45-year-old man and saying goodbye to my father in the hospital.
Do you think that The Longest Trip Home healed you in ways that maybe Marley and Me didn't?
I think that would be a fair statement because I think for me, emotionally, that was a more important story. I mean, one's about life lessons from this dog who challenged us, and one's about my parents, my family, my loved ones that helped form me as a human being, and that like 40-year experience with them. So it was like a catharsis for me. It really felt like writing the book. I thought I knew what the book was when I started it, but every page of writing it, I felt it like leading me, almost like a Ouija board, leading me to new truths and knowledge about that relationship. I used to teach writing at Lehigh for several years, and I would talk to the students about that, how the act of writing itself leads you to the story. You might think you know what your story is, but as you're writing and connecting words into sentences, they lead you, they pull you along, and you might amaze yourself at what comes out of you.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you taught at Lehigh, and some of the listeners here might not realize that you're in the Lehigh Valley, right? Can you tell me a little bit about your journey here? How did that happen? Because you were at, you were in South Florida with Jenny, right? And
yes.
Then you guys came here?
Yes. So okay. We were working at competing newspapers in South Florida, Lauderdale for me and Palm Beach for Jenny. And I've always been an avid gardener, and I was reading Organic Gardening magazine, and they had an ad for a managing editor. And I was like, kind of on a whim. I was like, why don't I just send him a resume? It sounds kind of fun. I get to write about gardening. And quite frankly, I'd been a columnist for a while, and I was feeling a little not challenged anymore. I knew I was pretty good at it, and I was like looking for like the next challenge. And so I came up and interviewed with Maria Rodale and got the job, and that's what moved us to the Lehigh Valley.
Rodale Publishing.
Rodale Publishing in Emmaus, and I became managing editor and then editor of the flagship magazine that started the company, Organic Gardening.
Yeah.
And I was only there about 4 or 5 years, and I really missed writing. You know, I was in management and dealing with personnel and all those things that I realized one of my lessons from that job was that I'm really a creative, and I'm really not meant to manage. That's, I don't think I was horrible at it, but it didn't feel natural to
right.
me. And so I got a job as a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, but did not have to move my family. And that's what got me here. And we sort of thought we'll go to the Lehigh Valley for a couple of years. And it's been 20...
Says everybody.
20-some years. And as we were talking off camera before, we both really like it here.
And yeah. So did Marley and Me happen after you went to the Philadelphia Inquirer then?
Yes, okay. It did. I was sort of like...
From a timeline perspective.
I was working those ideas in my head, but it was when I was at the Inquirer, writing 3 columns a week, and which is a lot for a columnist, I sort of managed to find the energy for writing the book in the early morning hours around my job.
Okay, I'm going to ask the question that everybody probably once answered. When Hollywood first reached out about adapting Marley and Me, what was your reaction? What was it like? That's pretty awesome. I mean, you have to say, you have to take it in for a second, right? And well, then no less Jennifer Aniston and Owen Wilson, who are like A actors at that point, you know?
Yeah, they were definitely A-list, and the movie was a fully funded movie. It was, you know, it was a big release for the studio. I just to give you this, set the scene, I was at a public library in Martin County, Florida, which is north of West Palm Beach, giving a little talk to members of the community there. And during a break, I got a phone call, and it was my agent. And she said, stay on the line. I'm going to put on Matthew, the film agent. And he gets on and he says, we have a studio on the other line, and here's their offer. But if we hang up, the offer's off the table. Like, they didn't want us to then go out and shop it around. So it happened in a parking lot outside a library after dark. I'm standing in the dark in a gravel parking lot. And we talked it through, and we said, yes. I mean, it was a great studio, a big studio. All the numbers were attractive. So that's how it happened. And I had to go back in and finish my talk.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was so distracted.
You think?
I think I told the audience, I said, you're not going to believe what just happened in the parking lot. They're making a movie out of Marley and Me.
At this point, did you know who the actors were going to be or not yet?
No, that was like months down the road.
Okay.
And I was part of the process of sort of discussing that choice.
Did you pick Owen for you, and did Jenny pick Jenny for her?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
We didn't have that much control.
Okay.
But they ran it by us and explained their thinking. Of course, we're fans of both of them.
Yeah.
And
the chemistry was fantastic.
Their chemistry was fantastic.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, I spent a lot of time on set, and Jenny did too, kind of watching behind the camera. And I always say that like the true test of like a person is when the cameras aren't on them. And like just off camera, on the set or behind the set, playing soccer with my kids and taking pictures with the children. And they were just both really very nice. And so, yeah, it felt like an honor to be played by them.
What was it like to see them play you? Meaning for those actors to interpret, for any actor really, to interpret your story. What was that like? Was that surreal? Did you want to stop filming and say, we didn't quite get that scene right? Like, what was that like to see somebody else playing out your life?
Well, it was kind of an out-of-body experience. In fact, when we first got on the set, like on one of the early days of shooting, there were two of those, like, you know, film chairs, the canvas chairs behind the camera. And one said John and one said Jenny. And we started to sit in them. And they go, oh, no, this is for the John and Jenny, you know, the two actors.
Yeah.
And so it was like having this doppelganger. It was a good experience for us. Of course, like every actor and the director and the writers of the screenplay, they brought their own personalities into it. But especially with Owen, he really sort of intuited things from just talking with me. And he brought a subtle kind of personality to it that I don't think I really wrote in the book, but he kind of sort of figured out how to play me and that kind of personality that I have. And, you know, we don't look anything alike, of course, but
I don't know about that.
Maybe when I was a younger man. but he kind of captured, it was weird. I was watching it, so like, God, that feels like something I would say and do. And it's not something I wrote in the book. He like kind of figured it out from just being with me.
So my 6-year-old daughter, because I'm the host, I can ask this question. But she had a question, a couple questions actually. One, have there been any new Marleys? How many were used for the film? And why was he so bad?
Well, I'll start with the last
question. That's for Gracie.
So, of course, any dog owner, I think, knows the answer to this. Marley wasn't bad. He was, you know, he was a sporting Labrador. There are different subgroups of Labrador. And we didn't know. And we got this one who's meant to be a field Labrador out hunting, diving in icy water. He had so much energy. And we lived in a 1,200-square-foot cottage. And the vet, like pretty early on, he diagnosed him as having ADHD. Everyone thinks it's a joke, but it's true.
Oh,
and he
my.
Gave us a sedative for him. He says, yeah, this dog has an attention deficit problem. So he was very hard to train, and he had so much energy that he was just a boisterous riot in our lives. So that was Marley. He wasn't a bad dog. If anything, we were weak and clueless owners. I think a stronger owner would have trained him better than we did. But we loved him right to the end. We never got rid of him, and that's what happens to a lot of dogs like this.
Yeah.
As far as the movie, I think they used, I think it was 18 was the number, different dogs and puppies to portray Marley in his various stages. And in fact, the director and producer of the film, at the very end, they gifted us one of the little puppies. His name was Woodson, and so we had him for his whole life.
Also the same breed,
yeah,
obviously.
They were all yellow labs.
Wow.
And kind of an interesting story is when they went to find the dog to play the main Marley as a young adult dog up until the point they used a different dog for the senior years because they needed a dog with a gray muzzle and everything. That dog, to their credit, they didn't go looking from high-end breeders. They went to rescues of Labradors who had been turned back in because they were incorrigible. And they got this crazy wild dog, a lot like Marley, whose name was Clyde. And the trainer was this tiny German woman. She stood about 5 foot even. And she was awesome. And she took this crazy dog and she corralled his energy and trained him to do those scenes, but with the high energy that these Labradors can bring. So Clyde was a character and a handful, and, you know, he would naturally have the tongue hanging out and the saliva and the panting, all those things that you can't really teach a dog to do.
Right.
Yet they could train him to, like, jump through a screen door on command, jump up on the counter and grab a turkey and run away with the turkey.
Oh, my gosh.
Those were all real scenes that they trained the dog to do. So, yeah, so that was a fun thing.
And so you've had Woodson. Have you had other yellow labs?
Yes.
And have they all been yellow labs?
They have.
Okay.
We love the breed. Everyone says, why do you keep getting these dogs? So we're on our fifth one since Marley. We had a female, Gracie, and then we got Woodson off the set. And they both lived their lives out. And then Wallace. And now we have a young, very spirited lab named Louie.
Oh.
And he's great, but he's a little bit like Marley in that he has a lot of energy.
Oh, here we go again.
On separate occasions, he put both of us in the ER.
Oh, my.
Just by, like,
oh, boy.
He lunged off the porch and took my wife with him.
You heard it first here. That might be the start of a new story.
Yeah. So, yeah, Louie and me. I don't think so.
Across your writing and life experience, what has Marley and your own story taught you about love, patience, and imperfection?
Well, I think that's the theme of the book, is that we as humans are not islands, and we need humans and pets and others around us to be whole. We're not meant to live alone.
Mm.
And
to a degree, we're pack animals.
We are,
yeah.
And we are, and just like dogs are, and that's why we've had this symbiotic relationship for tens of thousands of years. And Marley, like a lot of humans, was not perfect, and none of us is perfect. And you either move on or you figure it out. And so I think our story is a testament to the messy art of relationships, where it's frustrating, it can drive you crazy, you can be on the verge of giving up. And we were a couple of times.
Yeah.
And you either walk away or you stick with it. And in our case, we stuck with it. And we're rewarded in the end with a really rich experience.
And so with everything you've experienced, the book, the movie, the impact, what do you hope your legacy as a storyteller will be?
Oh, gosh. I think my legacy, I hope, will be that I am someone who, through a lot of hard work over my whole life, starting as a young writer in like 7th, 8th grade, I started playing with it, figured out how to reach my fellow humans through the written word. And that's a powerful thing when you can do it. And it feels really powerful and emotionally rich and compelling. And when you can do that, and I think Marley and Me is a testament to that. I hope my other writing is as well, that the written word can be very powerful when used to kind of connect humans together. And speaking of words, it's a two-way street. I've gotten so many, I mean, literally thousands of super beautiful letters and notes from people all over the world,
mm-hmm.
from Australia and Korea and Brazil and many Americans, of course. And their words move me to the point that as much as I can, I write people back and I say, you know, I just really appreciated hearing this from you. And it's 20 years later, I just got a beautiful note yesterday morning from a woman in Canada, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, your story is inspiring and amazing. Millions of readers and moviegoers have cried, laughed, grieved, and healed because one man chose to write honestly about his imperfect dog and his imperfect life. John didn't just set out to create a phenomenon. He set out to tell the truth. And somehow, that truth became a Hollywood film, a cultural touchstone, and a love letter to every messy, loyal, once-in-a-lifetime animal any of us have ever known. John, thank you for reminding us that stories don't have to be polished to be powerful. They just have to be real. To our listeners, may you love harder, laugh louder, and give your wildest companions a little extra grace today, because sometimes the world's worst dog turns out to be the best thing that ever happened to you. This is Trailblazers. I'm your host, Melody Bradford. We'll see you next time.